I computed the curvature tensor of a particular metric that looked had a sort of symmetry of a wall, but rather than compute it specifically in four dimensions, I did it in a general number of dimensions. So this was what we did, and it turned out to be a fairly easy computation using that Cartan formalism. So we found that the connection one forms were just the, instead of calling them naught, I'll call them theta gamma, were the connection one forms of the gamma metric, whatever they may be. We found that there was also a cross term with the dependence of what we sometimes call this warp factor, A. And then when we computed the curvature two forms, we saw that they were, given in terms of the background two forms. Plus some derivatives of the warp factor. Sorry, this is not the two form, these are the Ricci components that I've written down here. So this was what we calculated, and it was reasonably straightforward. So what I want to do now is to build up just, this is really a sort of like a Lego brick of building gravitational solutions in higher dimensions. So I want to start combining now different bricks so you can see how things piece together. But before doing that, I just want to actually just even look at this metric and just discuss some very simple black brain solutions. So suppose A is identically 1. So we're not trying to do anything particular at all. All we've done is we've tagged on an additional direction, z. Then obviously all the derivatives of A vanish, so rzz vanishes. And r mu nu is just 1 over A squared r naught mu nu. So if gamma, this gamma mu nu of x here, if that is an Einstein manifold, in other words, if it has vanishing Ricci tensor, then the Ricci tensor of this higher dimensional metric will also vanish. And of course, that's true whether z is, there's just one z or several z. So let's have a look at an example of this. Which is called a black string. And for this, all we do is we take the Schwarzschild metric and add an extra dimension, z. So our full metric is simply Schwarzschild with one extra dimension. So our horizon now is cylindrical. So that's just a one-dimensional solution. Look, we call it the string because it's got one spatial degree or extent. And so if I let dz squared go to sort of dz squared, where now this is just some flat n-dimensional manifold, I got the same argument. I can build it up iteratively. I can add another dimension to this metric with no warp factor. And because this satisfies vacuum Einstein equations in however many dimensions, the n plus one dimension, d plus one dimensional metric will also satisfy it. So this gives us what we would call a black brain, a very simple black brain, and it's just Schwarzschild cross R to the n. So the reason for the for the name brain is simply that in obviously in four dimensions, all we can have is a string or a wall, because once we can only have a one-dimensional spatial object or a two-dimensional spatial object. And of course, another name for a wall is a membrane. And however, if you go to higher dimensions, you could have, instead of a two-dimensional membrane, you can have a three-dimensional membrane, et cetera, et cetera. So when people were exploring solutions in supergravity in the sort of early 80s, then they wanted to have a sort of general name for these extended objects. So it became just brain rather than membrane. So let's have a look now at trying to build something a little more general, because at the moment, all we've got is a sort of single flat orthogonal space with something going on in one sort of subspace. So let's try and build something a little more general. So now I'm going to say I'm going to take two of these arbitrary metrics. So the idea here is this g mu nu depends on x, and this thing has dimensions p. And here, this gamma depends on y, and we're saying this has dimensions n. So I'm just piecing together now two of these little Lego bricks. And it's reasonably clear from the Cartan approach that the connection one forms of G and gamma don't mix at this level. And so what I can just do is I can really read off my connection by looking at my basic building block. So I can read off that if I take the G ones, fit it on without it looking too squashed. So I haven't really done any work here because you can see just from the structure of the Cartan equations that all you're doing is doing the same calculation that we did the other day for the domain wall, and you're doing it either in the G subspace or in the gamma subspace. So you don't really need to do much work there. Then when it comes to calculating the curvature two forms, you can see that again, if you just stick exclusively to one subspace or the other, the G or the gamma, you're going to get the same answers. So once again, you don't have to think, you just copy them down from the previous calculation. However, of course, at the level of the curvature two forms, you've got cross terms, the theta wedge theta pieces, and you can see that mu and alpha can talk to each other precisely through these components. So all you pick up is one extra sort of family of curvature two forms. So so I just rewrite them down, but they were in the notes. So I've just written down the ones associated with gamma here. You've got exactly the same sort of things for mu nu, except with an A instead of C. And so that's the new term. So provided you're in a situation where you can kind of decompose your metric into these block diagonal pieces, where within each box in your block diagonal you have a lower dimensional metric, then you know exactly how to combine those tensors together to give you the higher dimensional Riemann curvature. So you're really just kind of, you know, for Riemann, you're taking, if Riemann's exclusively in a subspace, you're more or less just picking out the curvature of the subspace plus warp factor corrections. Or you've got crosstalk between the two subspaces, but that occurs in mixed Riemann components, and those are only ever sort of gamma-gamma terms, and so they're always first order. So you see, you can start to sort of build up an intuition of the pattern of the way a curvature tensor depends on the various different subspaces from which your, you know, the full metric is constituted. So we can read off our Riemann components. So that was what I was saying, where something is exclusively in the one of the subspaces, you simply get the background Riemann plus warp factor pieces, and then you've got the pieces that come with the extra dimension R. So here's your Riemann tensor for that higher dimensional metric that we wrote down on the top right-hand corner with relatively little pain. So I want to talk about vacuum solutions, or maybe not vacuum solutions. So obviously I need to just write down the Ricci tensor. A lot of writing down today. So the way I've written it down there, you can kind of see the pattern that, you know, that you're getting from each of these subspaces. So if you have more than one dimension in your subspace, you pick up a sort of square of the first derivative of that warp factor. And in the crosstalking, you see these dimensionality of these subspaces coming in. So this is really a building block for building pretty much most black brains that you're likely to come across. So what I'm going to do now is to discuss a few solutions to the, you know, to the Einstein equations. We'll start with vacuum solutions and discuss why these, you know, why these are important or what they're used for. So here I've just done one. You can imagine sort of building up some quite general dimensional solutions. So let's look at a first example. Of a higher dimensional black hole. So this is the simplest possible case, you might think. It's a Schwarzschild solution. But instead of in four space-time dimensions, it's going to be in some n-dimensional space-time. So how does that fit inside the family that I wrote down at the top? Well, if I just take p equals 1 and say that all I've got is dt squared, that's my sort of standard Schwarzschild-looking potential. And then if I take my gamma to be the metric on a unit d minus 2 sphere, then that's what I would expect a black hole to look like. So I'll deal with gauge in a moment, but here we're going to say ds squared is so that's how we would build or start to look at finding a higher dimensional Schwarzschild solution. So if I just read off my curvature, So this is what I have to solve. I set those functions to zero and I solve it. However, because we kind of we're sort of not newbies at this, we're sort of a little bit slyer, we know that this might not be the best gauge to do this computation in. So I'm going to simply look for a solution. With C as rho, and then I'm going to say that d rho on A is equal to dr. So I'm simply changing gauge, and I'm simultaneously going right to the, cutting to the chase. I'm saying that I'm expecting my potential to look, I'm expecting my metric to look pretty much like Schwarzschild, but possibly with a different Newtonian potential. So I mean, obviously, doing both of these choices is kind of an assumption, but as long as it works, we're okay. So it's an assumption at this point. So I just need to rewrite my curvature in terms of my new radial coordinate rho. And so now and from now on, my prime is just going to be d by d rho, so just be warned. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at the theta-theta equation, mainly because it doesn't have an A double prime term in it. And so if I manipulate that, I should end up with a first order equation. And if you remember, when we looked at the spherically symmetric metric, so when we were deriving Schwarzschild, or in fact, actually the metric of a star, it was a first-order equation that was the most helpful in getting started and getting a physical interpretation of the constant of integration, which was a mass term. So if I look here at r theta theta, so it's got a c double primed on c in it. So here's my, or where this is now d squared c by dr squared. So this is my A primed. So here we've got that term becoming AA primed on rho. Then I've got the second piece, which is dA by d rho dC by d rho. So dA by d rho is just going to be AA primed. dA by dr is AA primed. dC by dr is A. And so what I end up with is yet another AA primed on rho. Then I've got the term in brackets. And dC by dr is just A. And of course, 1 over C squared is just 1 over rho squared. So that's my theta-theta component of Ricci, and I can rewrite this as a total derivative. Rather like we did with Schwarzschild. And so the only thing that changes in higher dimensions is the factor of rho here. And in fact, if you were looking at a Laplacian in higher dimensions, it's exactly this factor of rho that you would get. So our potential looks like Schwarzschild, but with a different fall-off in R, and the fall-off in R is exactly what you would expect from a Newtonian, or Newtonian potential, so it's a solution to the Laplace equation in the relevant number of dimensions. So if I try to identify with a mass, minus c really here. So the way I do this is I look at the way the metric falls off at infinity, and I kind of do the equivalent of a Newtonian gravity in d dimensions, and I identify what I get with, you know, what the fall-off is in terms of the constant to what we would normally interpret as the mass. So this is the relation that I get. And of course, it's quite, if I just want to do this Euclidean trick, if I go near the event horizon, I look at what my TR or tau rho section of the metric looks like. I can approximate V, where I suppose that V is A squared. I suppose I've put my notes in notation V simply because I'm thinking of a Schwarzschild potential. So if I want regularity, I have this same relation that the periodicity of tau has to be 4 pi over the derivative of the potential at the horizon. And so my temperature of the higher dimensional black hole is this V plus primed over 4 pi, which is given in terms of the horizon radius. And if I rewrite that in terms of mass, sometimes it just doesn't respond. Put it up a little so you can see. So we see that the temperature of a higher dimensional black hole is still inversely proportional to mass. It's a different power now, but it still increases as the mass decreases. So we don't solve the problem of negative specific heat simply by adding extra dimensions to a black hole. So it's a slightly different dependence, but it's the same sort of picture. And then I should just tell you that obviously you can get rotating higher dimensional black holes, but because in higher dimensions, your rotational group is now more, it's obviously a bigger group, and you have more sort of the equivalent of J3. So if you're in the O4, for example, you can have two commuting different spins. So you can rotate either in the XY plane or the ZW plane. So obviously there's the angular momentum of a black hole in higher dimensions is a more, you know, more involved story, but I'll just give you an example. So here's an example where it's sort of quotes straightforward, unquote, to write down the metric of a rotating black hole. It's rotating in just one subplane, and you can see that because it's picked out, the theta and phi are sort of picking out this subplane. So you can sort of see the structure there. You've got one subspace, which is a D minus four sphere. So you've got your time direction, your radial direction, and you're splitting up the remaining D minus two directions into a sort of D minus four sphere, and then the other two directions, the orthogonal directions, the angle in that plane is phi. And so if there was no rotation, you'd kind of have r squared cos squared theta d omega d minus 4 and r squared sine squared theta d phi squared. So you can see how you're kind of splitting up. You know, there's all sorts of different ways you can split up your subspace, the sort of unit, what would be if it wasn't rotating, a unit d minus 2 sphere. So in this case, you've separated out one two-dimensional plane, you're rotating in that plane, and so you can see the sigma and delta are exactly the same functions that appear as in Kerr. So you can sort of see how you're building up these higher dimensional solutions. Though obviously, you know, to build up a general rotating solution, it's a lot more complicated. So in pretty much a tour de force paper in the, I think it was the late 80s, Rob Myers and Malcolm Perry went through looking at the vacuum solutions for higher dimensional black holes. So asymptotically flat solutions in arbitrary dimension. Clearly the equivalent of higher dimensional Schwarzschild is reasonably straightforward, but for rotation, you've obviously got to look into the structure of the rotation group and properly take into account, you know, if you have arbitrary rotation parameters. So that was what they did. And as I say, it's quite a tour de force paper. You know, there's a lot in there. The that formula for the mass is also from that paper. So it's sort of one of these things. And at the time, it was probably the situation where people were saying, why are you doing that? So it was still the early days of superstring theory. And at the time, string theorists didn't have a clue about, well, that's, I'm going to be murdered if I say that, didn't have a clue about gravity, but actually it's not that far from the truth. It's sort of, you know, initially they weren't really interested in these sorts of gravitational issues because gravity was a perturbative spin 2 particle, which they knew how to deal with. So, but Malcolm and Rob were sort of thinking further into the future and imagining, well, come on, if you're going to have higher dimensions in string theory, you need to know about gravitating solutions. So let's start trying to map out that space.
So the black hole solution known as the Myers-Perry solution is with two rotations, right?
I take Myers-Perry actually to be any higher dimensional black asymptotically flat, because that's what they did.
Did they include charges?
You're asking me. Is this tome of a paper? They may have done in terms of a high. I don't honestly remember, Tibra. I know for sure they did all these higher dimensional vacuum solutions. We'll see how the time goes. But the more general black brain solutions, that was Horowitz and Strominger later on when, again, string theorists began to see the light. So, okay. So another fascinating metric is a metric in five dimensions. So we used to think when Myers and Perry did that work, we thought, okay, we knew that there was the black string. But the black string is not asymptotically flat because the horizon stretches out to infinity. So it seemed as if you had a black hole, a black string, a black membrane, black general brain, et cetera, et cetera. But if you were dealing with asymptotically flat space-times, then all you could have was the black Myers-Perry black hole family. Not so. about just over 10 years ago. This is sort of one of these examples where you're looking for one thing and find something else. There was a lot of effort being directed at trying to find the higher dimensional C metric, so this accelerating black hole metric. The reason being that we were interested in having large extra dimensions. We thought maybe we lived on a brain world, and if we were going to properly look, analyze production of black holes at the LHC, we needed to have a solution of a black hole on a brain, and for reasons, sort of set of reasons, we needed an accelerating black hole solution. So Roberto and Harvey were looking for this, and what they did was they started with the C metric. Now I'm just going to write down the black ring metric, and I'll then sort of talk a little bit about it. So I apologize for how long this is, but I guess you can start to see why people hadn't found it before. So this is the metric. Mu is 2gma, so that's a familiar thing from our C metric. This little constant C depends on the roots of G. This chalk and me do not get on. More or less a C metric anyway. So what this is, it is related to the C metric, though it may not look like it at first sight. So you can see the same structure here of F and 1 over F and G and 1 over G coming in. It's slightly modified. So first of all, this is in the spatial part. You can see. So psi would have been time for our C metric. So if you remember, I did this sketch of the accelerating black holes. It's a very strange black hole, but anyway. As being a sort of fully analytically continued C metric. Now, if I Wick rotate the C metric, then hyperboloids tend to turn into circles. So if you have x squared minus t squared is some constant, that goes to x squared plus tau squared is some constant. Perhaps I should use r here rather than x. So that turns into this sort of structure. So the event horizon is now a little tube. So that's sort of explaining this part of what's going on. And then you can see that this metric also has some rotation in the sense that there's a cross term between this angle, which is actually the analytically continued time from the C metric, and our bona fide five-dimensional time. So what that means is we are rotating this tube in this Euclidean time, which is now an angle direction. So geometrically, this describes a little ring, and it's rotating. So in the C metric, we had conical singularities, but it turns out So you can kind of imagine if you had this ring, it might want to contract, or you know, just a gravitational attraction. But if you spin it up, that's going to sort of counterbalance a contraction. So previously, if you didn't want the ring to contract, you would have to put a little conical deficit around the outside to pull it outwards. But as you rotate it up, you kind of lower the deficit angle you need until eventually it just goes away. So there are no conical deficits in this metric when it's sort of properly set up. And they constructed it, in fact, in the early 90s, people were looking at taking the C metric and doing a Kaluza-Klein C metric. So this is really where it comes from. It's an analytically continued Kaluza-Klein C metric. So we're going to do Kaluza-Klein next week, but for now, we're just talking about higher dimensional solutions themselves. So what's interesting about the black ring is that you can see from here, from this piece, this cross term, it has angular momentum. It also, as you go off at large y, you can also see it's asymptotically flat. So it's a bit like Myers-Perry, far away, but as you come in, you see that instead of having a black hole looking like this, you've got a spinning black ring. So it means that unlike four dimensions, where for asymptotically flat spacetimes, your horizons had to be spherical, in higher dimensions, we can have different topologies. And in fact, people, as one does, then went on to generalize and found solutions with a rotating ring around a black hole. So this was a black Saturn, and so on and so forth. So essentially, you can, by looking at the structure of the Einstein equations and using various arguments from integrability, you can kind of see that you can construct sort of arbitrary sort of sets of rings around sort of black holes. So it's kind of, it's quite a nice little story there, this non-uniqueness.
Why does it not work in 4D?
So in four dimensions, it's essentially coming back. So that's why I stressed asymptotically flat, actually. If you remember when I was discussing the Schwarzschild potential, the general solution, we saw we had a kappa minus 2gm on r, and then we had minus lambda on 3r squared, and the kappa was the curvature of sort of, in this case, you know, d omega 2 squared was, so that would be kappa equals 1, dx squared would flat would be kappa equals 0, and you know, the two-dimensional hyperboloid was kappa was minus 1. Then in, I mean, this is sort of just a heuristic argument, but basically you can see that if you're in anti-de Sitter, you can have a planar or a hyperbolic black hole, but if you're in vacuum or de Sitter, it's got to be spherical. You can't have cylindrical event horizons in 4D gravity unless you're in anti-de Sitter. So it's to do with the way you build these solutions up. If you wanted a cylindrical event horizon, you'd have to build some solution here where, so you'd have to sort of take these building blocks. You'd end up with a T, an R, a phi, which would be the sort of angle around, and then you'd have an extra piece. And so so that's a sort of slightly different class. It's a little more, you know, there's more degrees of freedom in the metric, but if you look at those class of metrics and try and find a cylindrical solution with a horizon, you don't get one in vacuum. Okay, so really it's just looking at the structure of the vacuum solutions. Is there a sort of physical wave, quick wave. I guess one perhaps hand-wavy way of saying why that's the case is sometimes you get intuition about solutions in higher dimensions. But so, for example, a cylindrical solution would be looking at a three-dimensional gravitator, you know, by projecting down along the cylinder, would be like looking at three-dimensional gravity, possibly with extra fields. And so in four dimensions is the lowest number of dimensions in which gravity propagates through the vacuum, which you've got, you know, gravitational waves. So in three dimensions, it's like you're much more restricted. And so you don't kind of get this structure in three dimensions, again, unless you're dealing with negative cosmological constant. So why? So remember, we were talking about entropy, and the entropy being the log of microstates. And so this notion was that in four dimensions we had this idea that a black hole was characterized by very few parameters. So one of the reasons why it was sort of exciting at the time when black rings first came out was this idea of here within the context of classical gravity, you were starting to get solutions which were identical asymptotically, where you were measuring charges, but were different once you got close up. So here's where you start to see more coming in. Okay, so there's more degrees of freedom. Unfortunately, as it turns out, which we will be discussing later, most of these solutions are not actually stable, so they're not really legitimate extra degrees of freedom. So I'd just like to finish off by just introducing, again, without, you know, doing formally extra dimensions, I'm just going to introduce higher dimensional brains, but with charges. So this is really where this part of classical gravity starts to meet with string theory. So in So in string theory, we're often interested in classical solutions of a higher dimensional supergravity. So these could be either as backgrounds or as alternative descriptions of objects that you have an inherently stringy description of. But there's a whole slew of possible solutions, and these were categorized by Horowitz and Strominger. So our action, if I look at a 10-dimensional focus on a particular number of dimensions, that's minus sine. So I'm just giving a sort of schematic representation. This is your sort of general type 2 supergravity action. And although, you know, we will be coming back to some of these concepts next week, we've already met this. Remember I discussed the H was dB, the 2 form, where B was a 2 form potential. Here, this is the same notion, but where now A is a p-form potential. So dA is like the field strength. And depending on whether P is odd or even, that tells you which sort of supergravity that you're actually in. So for example, 2B supergravity will have even P's and 2A supergravity will have odd P's. That's the right way around, I've got it. And so analogous to Riesen and Nordström, we can charge up solutions with respect either to these forms or the two form. So for example, we've got electric solutions. So when we mean an electrically charged solution, I'll focus in just by giving it for this, the two form, would have an HTR, let's say, X. So the important thing is that there's a T component in there. And then you have magnetic solutions where H would now be sort of three angles, theta, phi, psi, and it would be the area form on an S3. No, sorry, it's B theta, phi. Something else. No, do I mean not trying to think? F, no, it is F theta phi, isn't it? So these are just a sort of, I'm just trying to get across the sort of concept of the type of solutions that you can build. Now in four dimensions, again, it sort of seems that four dimensions is sort of really special and there's lots of magic that happens in four dimensions. But in four dimensions, the black hole can be charged either with respect to an electric charge or a magnetic charge. In other words, both electric, sort of electrons and magnetic monopoles are point particles. However, in higher dimensions, typically, here you can see that if this is an electrically charged object, then it's actually going to correspond, remember I put just this spatial direction x, this is going to correspond to something which is a string, and it's going to have the sort of transverse space is going to be nine-dimensional. So, sorry. Eight-dimensional. Whereas your magnetically charged object here, this is an area form on a three-sphere. So the three-sphere surrounds the black hole. And so in this case, this turns out to have an extent in five spatial directions. So you can see the dimensionality of the electric and magnetic solutions tend to be different. So I just want to finish off with an example where it's sort of charged, where the electric and the magnetic would both have the same dimensionality. And you can see that if I now add another two indices to my H, then that sort of steps me up from a string to a two-brain to a three-brain. And if I have an area form on a five-sphere, then my transverse space is like in spatial directions of four, transverse spatial directions, and so I hop down from a five to a four to a three. So if I then ask, well, what is this five form? It turns out I don't have separately charged electric and magnetic D3 brains. So this, it's a five form, so it comes from a four form potential. So this is in 2B, supergravity. And it turns out this has to be self-dual. So our D3 brains are actually both electrically and magnetically charged. It's just a requirement of the particular five form. So our three brain metric has the following general form. So this is a general three brain. So notice we've got R plus R minus. So our five form is proportional to a single charge, where this charge is, that might be Q squared, but the charge is proportional to the product. We've got R plus R minus. So this is like looking at a Riesler-Nordström type solution that's non-extremal. That's what this is doing. And as R plus tends to R minus, this would be like extremal in gravitational language. What we tend to is actually the D3 brain metric. And so this D here stands for something specific, stands for Dirichlet. And the reason is that these, you find that if you apply, if you're doing open strings and you apply Dirichlet boundary conditions, so in other words, you try and fix the string on some hypersurface, then the equations of motion of the hypersurface actually coincide with the sort of degrees of freedom of this classical solution. So the reason for the D moniker means Dirichlet boundary conditions. So this D3 brain in string theory is an important solution because this was the sort of prototypical gravitational solution that Maldacena used when he developed his gauge gravity correspondence, ADS-CFT. So this is where we have a very direct correspondence between gauge theories that we get when we look at the sort of stringy side and the boundary conditions on the end of the open string, as opposed to a gravity side where when we look in near an event horizon, or which turns out not to be quite what you thought it was, of the extremal black brain, what you find is this R goes to a constant at the event horizon, and what you're left with is sort of locally like an anti-de Sitter space. So this is why anti-de Sitter space is an important space to study in sort of modern string theory. I'll stop there.